the future.
There are no people.
There are no people in the future.
No people at all.
There are no people in the future.
Where did all my people go?
There are no people in the future.
Let me try my people call.
Welcome to Raging Chickens Out to Coop Live. Yes, it is Monday, May 31st, 2021. It is Memorial Day, everybody. Yes, indeed. But we're here. We're here for you once again on this Monday evening. On Out to Coop Live, we talk to progressives, activists, and troublemakers of all sorts, right from our own backyards, from across the country. On Fridays, of course, Sean Kitchen and I break down the good, the bad, and the ugly in state and national politics. And we've got a brand new Wednesday show. Yes, it is the Wednesday show every other week. And actually, it's actually going to be every week now. I'm going to be talking to progressive columnists from the Bucks County Courier Times and the Intelligencer. That's Cyril Michaleko. Yes, you know him. You love him. You're already here with me. I know you are. Good. Well, he joins me to drill down into Bucks County and PA politics. You can get all our shows by subscribing to our podcast on Podbean, iTunes, Spotify, wherever you get your podcast. And make sure you leave us a review. Give us that 5-star review. Let people know you're doing what you think about the show, right? The more reviews that you give, especially on iTunes, especially on Apple Podcasts, boom, that gets us out there. You can help to support this show by becoming a patron for as little as $5 a month. Go to patreon.com/rcpress. And if you're watching this show right now on our YouTube channel, make sure you hit that subscribe button. Make sure you like the stream and hit that little bell, that little notification bell, so you get a notification every time that we go live. Yes, we'll have some details about too as well. If you want to join tonight's show, you want to call into the show a little bit later on in the second half of the show, you'll notice if you go down into the show notes on our YouTube, there'll be kind of a little click, a little link there that will take you to our Riverside audience room, where you can actually come in and kind of call into the show. We did this last week. It was kind of pretty successful. Kind of had a lot of fun, some of the call-ins. But I'll talk a little bit more about some of those details a little bit later on in the show. For more PA progressive talk, you can also tune to the Rick Smith Show's live stream at 9 p.m. Eastern on his YouTube channel, Twitter, or Facebook. Subscribe to his podcast wherever you get your podcast. And just go to thericksmithshow.com for all the latest across all his platforms. And you absolutely must check out the newly launched Sisters of the Night Caucus podcast. Yes, the amazing PA women stirring this political cauldron behind this podcast. They rock! And they know where the bodies are buried. Spooky, right? Yep. Well, make sure to follow them on Twitter, too, at The Night Caucus, and subscribe to their podcast on Anchor, Spotify, iTunes, or wherever you get your podcast. Attention gamers, The Game Inn is a Quakertown Black family-owned gaming store. Yes, they're friends of the show, and they've got everything you could want, from retro N64s to latest consoles, video games for all platforms, collectibles, action figures, Funko Pops, you name it. And if you got kids, hey, every A you get on the report card, they get a discount. That's not a bad deal. You can follow them on Twitter at The Game Inn. That's with two N's. You can drop them an email at thegameinnpa@gmail.com, or check out all their stuff on thegameinnwith2n's.com. And a special shout out once again to Jonathan Mann, who wrote our intro song, There Are No People in the Future. And check out all his great stuff on his YouTube page and follow him on Twitter. Well, on today's show, well, this week, I welcome Brian Bailey back to the program. Yes, Brian's been here before. And as we've kind of taken on the assault in higher ed, yes, Brian is back. He's back to the program to talk about a new report called COVID-19 and Academic Shared Governance by the American Association of University Professors, or AAUP. The report finds that college university administrations' responses to the COVID-19 pandemic, well, guess what they did? Surprise, surprise. They disregarded the norms of academic governance and were affected largely by administrative fiat with little or no consultation with the faculty. Even where the austerity and emergency measures had dramatic effects on the curriculum, an area traditionally considered the faculty's primary responsibility. We may also dip into another recent report by the Roosevelt Institute Network, or the Roosevelt Network, called The Financialization of Higher Education at the University of Cincinnati, as well as the broader attack on public higher ed. Yes, it's all joy and fun tonight, everybody. Yes, Brian Bailey is an associate professor, and give him a round of applause. Yes, newly tenured associated professor, associated professor. You're an associated professor. You're associated with the professor. Congratulations again on that, Brian. Associate professor of rhetoric and composition at the University of Cincinnati's Blue Ash College. Brian's latest articles include Are We an Academic Journal? Editing as Ethical Practice for Change. That's co-authored with Steve Parks. And Reflections, a Journal of Community Engaged Writing and Rhetoric. And the ever-timely piece in present tense, I love to plug this one, that present tense is a Journal of Rhetoric and citing this piece called, quote, So Richard Spencer's coming to your campus. How he was allowed on and how you can confront him. Way to go. I want to remind you all too as well to join our Discord server. You can check out the link for that also in on our YouTube stream. Just look in the show notes. We're continuing to test this new platform tonight on riverside.fm. So we're hoping to continue kind of working out the kinks as we go on, but this is absolutely fantastic. You can join the show on riverside.fm by just following that link right down in the show notes on YouTube and be able to call in a little bit later on to the show. And to remind you once again that you've become a patron of this show and help support everything we do here at Raging Chicken by going to patreon.com/rcpress today. Welcome once again, Brian, back to Out to Coop Podcast.
Thank you for having me again.
You got it. And one more thing that I did not say in the intro, but happy birthday to you. Yes, it was Brian's birthday too as well. So not only did he get tenure this week and promoted this week, but he also had a birthday. So congratulations across the board, Brian. And I appreciate you taking the time out tonight to come on the show.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me. And thank you for the congratulations for tenure as well as my birthday. I must tell you, the closer I get to 50, the less celebration there is involved.
Hey, I'm still celebrating, man. I'm over the hump.
Yeah, you know, well, it just doesn't have that sort of same vibe anymore. You know, and I assume that's just age and maturity, I guess, right? So I'm not going to be silly and do something outlandish anymore.
True enough. And I think, you know, I think having kids has something to do with it. At least it did for me, because like after that, it's like, you know, the kids' birthday were a big deal. Then after, like, by comparison, it's like, we really don't need to celebrate, really. We don't have to do one more thing, do we? Have to? No, really, let's just like hang out and have a quiet night and watch a movie or something, you know. It's like
it's exactly what happened last night.
So that's it. Oh, good. Man, so I mean, here we are. We're kind of at the end of the academic year. It's been, I think it's fair to say, one of the most challenging academic years in anybody's memory. Not only did we, start this or end last spring with the launch of the pandemic, right, where suddenly we're all forced kind of online scrambling to figure out how we're actually going to do this thing in the midst of a pandemic. We've never done a pandemic before, at least not in my lifetime. Had to figure out, you know, what are the rules? What do we have to do? How do we protect ourselves? And that actually happened in the wake of like the George Floyd killings. And you had massive uprisings, some of the biggest kind of social, I mean, by some measures, like the largest civil rights protests in the history of this country. We also kind of were still experiencing the kind of the aftermaths of the Me Too movement, which things have continued to kind of roll out. And of course, last but not least, it was a presidential election year in which we finally got rid of Donald Trump after 4 years of just absolutely an onslaught of destruction. So, I mean, so here we sit in like the summer of 2021, after a full year of COVID and the wake of all that stuff. I mean, a lot has happened.
Right. And, you know, a lot has happened. And I think we're all really tired.
Yeah.
But I think that's also unfortunate, because that's the problem is those onslaughts aren't stopping. Right. So just because Trump is no longer in office and his administration is gone, I think it's one of the things that we have to keep looking for is we have to keep vigilant, basically. And we have to continue the resistance, because Trump is not necessarily he's not the foundation for all of this and what we're seeing in the United States. He's just the outcome of a long, long stretch of time, decades now,
exactly,
where, you know, that those neoliberal policies have taken hold and taken root. And ideas about what does an institution owe its people have dramatically changed. And I think that's the biggest thing with the Trump administration is it was close to the idea, that Grover Norquist idea of getting rid of all government as much as possible. And that's why it was such a hands-off sort of operation. besides the fact that he was obviously looting everything he could, you know.
Right. And I think, people started using that, that term about stress testing kind of our democracy and things like this. And I really do think that we had I'll speak for myself. I know there were certain things that I had taken for just as givens. Right. And not realizing that I have taken them as givens either. Right. Just for example, if you have a subpoena, you have to respond to it. Right. You have to show up. Right. You can't just say no and everything's fine.
Right.
Right. But we like things like this. Or, for example, there was a concern going into the Trump administration for things like when you with the EPA, for example, right, that he's going to put an EPA dude in there that he's going to go in and kind of like absolutely destroy the EPA. Right. And then there were people say, well, no, he's never going to get confirmed. How do we get to confirm? Well, he just realized, well, you just don't need to confirm him.
Yeah.
Right. You just have acting people, and the acting people can go in and they could do all this damage with even less accountability.
Right.
Right. I mean, so, and I think there was. In the wake of that, right, being positioned in higher ed, having to deal with the pandemic, right, having to kind of grapple with like how we actually like do teaching, right, and not just have students tick boxes, but actually to do it effectively, at least everyone I talked to, was a real struggle. And I I'm curious I know for me, it's been exhausting. Mm-hmm. It's been exhausting. I do think my spring semester, I was able to kind of do things a little bit better than I did in the fall. Right. Yeah. I learned some things that didn't work. I learned that, Zoom is actually not all fun and games, that it's actually absolutely exhausting.
Absolutely.
And exhausting for students, exhausting for me, that there were all sorts of kind of, you expose all sorts of technological failures at the university that we had, at least at Kutztown. A lot of that had to do with personnel, not with the technology, right? They didn't have the adequate people to actually there do that, or they were overworked. I mean, so that's from my end. But I mean, where do you sit after this year?
Well, and that's basically what happened all over, I think, what you said earlier with the stress test, is that everything was tested. And what I experienced was much the same, but I went asynchronous this year instead of going synchronous and online. So I was just using the learning management system that the university uses. And at the same time, I had already started moving to a few years ago contract-based grading in an effort to be more mindful of how competition and grades, how that's intertied with ideas of student worth, as well as concepts of white supremacy and racism. And so for me, it all hit at the right time because I could put that all together in one package. And then I could say, do this work. And if you do this work, you're guaranteed this grade, right? And we will take things really slow when it comes to technology. And I've kept it as bare bones as possible. But I learned that, much like you did, in the spring semester or through the fall into the spring, right? The whole idea of the technology. And I think that it also exposed for a lot of us, and exposed for me, which I shouldn't have been a surprise, but I teach at a two-year college within the larger University of Cincinnati system, that for how much we like to see ourselves as tech savvy, as a people, as a culture, as a society, that there are still a lot of people where access and tech literacy is a big hurdle.
Yes.
And that's, based on socioeconomic class, that's based on, it's based on policies that, again, go back to the history of the country. And that sort of generational lack of wealth is glaring, right? That inequality is glaring, where, I'm working with students to find them places near them, looking at like Google Maps, like where's free Wi-Fi, things like that. And so that I found exhausting. It was that emotional labor of carrying that sort of load to try to help students get through the issue. Or even as students were working or suddenly taking care of people, doing things like pirating copies of textbooks, right? Or sending them desk copies I had for textbooks, because they would literally talk, send me an email and say, or get on to my office hours, which I was using WebEx to do, which is similar to Zoom. Mm-hmm. And they would say like, I cannot afford this right now, but I want to take this class, right? So that emotional labor that was pushing down on us because of the stress test, I was it's been just such a hell of a year. Like, by the time we finished in April, I was just done. And usually I'm very much into, like, it's free time now, I can do what I want, whatever, whether it's family or it's projects. But since we stopped in April, I have worked at half time, if doing anything at all. And I still have to get ready for the summer because I'm just tired. You know, it's just so, I'm just so tired.
I hear you. And I think, you know, I spent a good, I don't know, more than a week, probably almost 2 weeks now, of just like digging in the dirt, like literally, you know, just kind of like spending time, you know, weeding and things like this. Just, you know, one, I like doing that, right? So it's kind of, you know, it feels like something life-giving, right? You're actually kind of involved with, you know, things growing and spring coming and all this stuff, but also just to kind of like detox, it felt like. From being like, you know, I'm literally like right now, like in my basement, right? You know, in front of a camera, in front of computers and things like this. And my kid, you know, my son was home like full time and my daughter was doing hybrid for a while. Then she went, you know, then they kind of brought them all back. And even managing all that stuff at the household level, right? And on top of all this was just, you know, exhausting. And I wish I could say that, you know, this was, you know, we like to hear out during a pandemic or crises or things like this, that we should all be pulling together, right? Because we're all on the same team, or we're all, you know, we got to pull together and do this. And I know I certainly got enough of those emails that were like, yes, we've got to work as a team. But at the same time that all this is going on and we're struggling to do our best, I think at least the vast majority of people that I knew that were teaching in higher ed struggling to do their best for their students. We saw that the continuation of this kind of assault on higher education from all these different angles. I mean, we've talked about some, you know, when you've been on before, we've talked about some of these before, but I mean, where does that sit kind of like out in kind of Ohio? Because one of the things, just to remind listeners, is like when Brian had first come back on last summer, right? Crazy assaults on faculty and tenure in Ohio. There were, you know, all, it looked like the wrecking ball was coming, right? We saw all these exposés that were coming out. You had amazing student journalists that were exposing what was happening in the amount of funds that were going to sports, right, over academics. That was last year. Yeah. And then this year, that it hasn't let up, it seems like, at all.
No, it hasn't. And so I can speak to say, like, you know, unfortunately, force majeure has worked in Akron. So they've basically, I believe it was Akron, they've basically blown all that up.
Remind everybody what that means. So I don't think everyone's going to be familiar.
Okay, so force majeure is also,
it's a beautiful concept, everybody.
it's very pretty French. And it basically, it's like, which you would also see as what's also been called an act of God clause. So unfortunately at Akron, what ended up happening was that within their collective bargaining agreement, they're an AAUP chapter university, so that means they have a union. They had actually put in a force majeure clause. And what that clause does is it says, if there is an act of God, this contract is null and void. So an act of God that affects the university and the university's ability to operate at a financially sound level.
Let's be clear, it's like usually what people are thinking about, right? If you're sitting and negotiating a contract like this, if I'm being the most generous person that I could be at this point, you think about act of God, you're thinking like, okay, if a tornado comes through and rips apart our campus, right? Or an earthquake opens up and our entire university falls into a pit of hell, right? I mean, that's what we're talking about when I think most people think about as an act of God. Right.
Or they think about, you know, Hurricane Katrina coming in and laying waste and, you know, dispersing students and faculty as they have no homes and staff, right? Support staff of all levels. Yeah. And so what ended up happening was that force majeure was enacted. And so they have basically blown the collective bargaining agreement out of the water, which means that everything's on the table and the administration can make the rules as they go. And so why they're calling force majeure is they're hiding behind this concept of the COVID-19 pandemic. And as we've talked about before, this is just disaster capitalism, but in academia. And all that they have done is that they basically were covering up their mismanagement. And so for years, the, you know, the institution's been financially mismanaged, and it's, you know, not faculty who are mismanaging it, because that's not their job. The job is the administration, right, in particular the Board of Trustees and the president, to keep the their hand on the wheel and to not fall asleep at the wheel when it comes to finances. But that hadn't happened, and so this was an out for them, right? So you still have institutions like Akron and other places as well all over the country who collected on that CARES Act that went through, right, which provided millions of dollars, you know, in relief for colleges and universities throughout the country. They still collected that and then didn't hire anybody back, didn't bring anybody back, didn't open up the programs again that they shuttered. And so that's the sort of thing that's been going on. And that's one of the things that the report that you mentioned earlier talks about, that the AAUP put out, is that the COVID-19 has pandemic has essentially been used as cover for a majority of institutions to continue to assault and to continue to corporatize the university.
Well, and one of the things I was really excited about this report. Again, you guys can get this report. It can be linked in the show notes for today. This is called Special Report, COVID-19 and Academic Governance. So just so if anybody is unfamiliar with this kind of concept, you have this idea about shared governance in academics, right? Is that you have administration and you have faculty members that are kind of sharing aspects of determining the direction of the university. And that's based on the assumption that the people who are in the classroom, the academics who are doing both the research and the teaching, are the experts in the field and the experts in terms of curriculum. And so our position to kind of best understand where there is. And while the administration is kind of like responsible for the overseeing of kind of all staffing on campus and figuring out, you know, it's budgeting and all this other kinds of stuff. And so the idea in a, you know, in an ideal world is that these two are have different perspectives and different angles on things. And so if they come together with shared governance, they can make best determinations for the university. So that's kind of the idea about, you know, the in a very, very kind of like nitty-gritty way, or easy to understand way, I guess. So in this, what I was extremely, and this has been eroded, and this is one of the things that we see happening in the pandemic, which this report kind of addresses. One of the things, but before we get into the kind of details of this, is that one of the things that I was thrilled about reading is that right in the introduction is they lay it out as disaster capitalism, right? Mm-hmm. That this is not, you know, they're not hedging their words here in terms of what is actually going on. So as a way of just kind of setting the tone, let me just read this one paragraph. This is kind of like in the introduction. It says, so the investigation on which this report is based, however, was prompted largely by opportunistic exploitations of catastrophic events. This phenomenon, generally known as disaster capitalism, a term coined by Naomi Klein, was exemplified in early December 2020 by James White, the interim dean of the College of Arts and Sciences at the University of Colorado at Boulder. This is great, everybody, okay? Just so... who, after announcing a long-term plan to replace tenured faculty members with non-tenure track faculty members, said, never waste a good pandemic. Even though the dean apologized the following week, calling his remarks flippant and insensitive, to many faculty members, the gaffe seemed to exemplify what in political circles is called saying the quiet part out loud. And in this respect, as in so many others, COVID-19 served as an accelerant, turning the gradual erosion of shared governance on some campuses into a landslide. And so I think that kind of like sets the tone for what's happening in this report. So let's get into some of the things that what do you see? What overall, first of all, what's your kind of sense of what was in this report? What are some of the kind of key takeaways? And then maybe we can get into some of the examples and some of the case studies here that help illustrate what's happening.
Yeah, so what's happening is it's an attack on shared governance, right? And so the reason that that's really, like you had said earlier, well, that's important, right? Because then you have two sides working together and they hash out a compromise. Very democratic, right? You know, if we live in a democracy, you would hope your workplace was democratic as well, right? You shouldn't suddenly for 8 hours go into a fascist state. But the other thing, yeah.
You would think,
right? But what ends up happening as well is that when these... when the shared governance is eroded in this way, what ends up happening usually, and the quickest way they can do it, if they don't have, and here I'm talking about the administration, if there isn't a force majeure clause in a collective bargaining agreement, it's oftentimes when there is no union representation at a university or college. And what they have instead of a collective bargaining agreement that has, you know, penalties, financial and, you know, some other penalties as well, that depends on the agreement, the faculty handbook is built on a handshake and a promise. And usually it's been developed years and years ago, right? And it was like faculty working with administration in a different time. But that handbook then becomes the ur-text for the entire faculty. It lists like, you know, things like compensation for, you know, overloading or for teaching a summer course, for, you know, times that you're allowed to go up for promotion, you know, where to get your parking pass, whatever. It covers all of it. And so,
and it's basically like uh-huh. It's basically like the assumed contract, right? Except without the teeth of an actual union contract, right?
Exactly.
It's like, you know, if you were to get a job description for a job that you were hired at some place and they hand you the employee handbook, that's essentially what we're talking about here.
Right? Absolutely. Yeah. Yep. Yeah. And so when what ends up happening is once the universities blow that up, there is no shared governance. Right. So what we're talking about in Boulder there is he gets rid of the entire faculty handbook. And then in turn, what this does is that means that there's no such thing as tenure. And that means that anybody can be fired for what they deem as just cause. And so what happens, and the report doesn't necessarily get into, is the idea that when you do that, then you don't have people who can sit on committees to participate in shared governance. There's only one side. There's the administration side. Because in most spaces, and I hate to say that I'm a part of an institution that does this, but adjuncts do not sit on committees. They don't have a voice in shared governance. Or if they do, it's largely symbolic. So you are then getting rid of a party that could push back. So basically, it's just a two-party system in a university. You have the administration, you have the faculty. They go back and forth, and they hash out a compromise.
Right, and the idea there is in a situation of crisis, right? So let's say, for example, and I think the report's very careful about kind of being clear that there were some of these institutions that were already experiencing financial strains to begin with, right? Mm-hmm. Which had, and there's a range of reasons for that, right? So, and they're also careful about saying this is not a one size fits all, that there are things that are specific to each of these institutions that you need to take into consideration. But several of them had these issues that were going before. They'll say, for example, there's a real crisis, right? Or a real budget issue. And what are you going to do? The idea in a shared governance situation, before you start kind of like, you know, just taking out the axe and hacking off programs, is the idea is that you say you would approach, you'd sit down with faculty members and say some of the areas, say, for example, that have maybe programs that have lower enrollment than others, right? That fewer students are taking, and say, hey, look, we're in this crisis. Can we think about a way, right, of adjusting how we offer these programs or how we kind of like organize our departments or something like this, you know, in the midst of this, because we're going to have to find a way of doing this. We'd rather not do this by slicing off programs and putting students at, you know, their programs at risk. So what are some of the ideas? What are some of the ways that we could approach this? And you'd bring the faculty in that precisely because the faculty are the ones who know the curriculum, have an idea about how maybe different ways that they could offer the programs, maybe ways of combining with some other departments that are doing similar work, right, as a way of kind of preserving the mission of the university and so on. So that would be the ideal case, right? You have this crisis, you sit down and you brainstorm and you're trying to figure out how to make it all work.
Yes. And the other thing is that almost all of these handbooks use the AAUP sets of guidance when it comes to shared governance. And the biggest part about that is the idea that faculty know the curricula and they can make the best curricula decisions, and it's their right to do so. And like you're saying, when you don't bring them in, you don't have those experts saying those things. You don't have those experts deciding those things. The big problem that I see overall with the report is when the administrations were doing this at these various colleges, and they were mostly small, I would say liberal arts colleges where this was happening, where the report focuses on, is that the administration was there deciding arbitrarily. And the biggest problem is that most administration, most boards of trustees are not academics. That time is long past. Because we've had the financialization, as the Roosevelt report points out, of higher education in the United States, that means that we are constantly seeing in universities and colleges, on those boards of trustees, and even the presidents of the colleges and universities, are former CEOs or CFOs of private, you know, corporations, of private, you know, sector corporations, because they're constantly being recruited and paid to start doing things at the university that can be commercialized and put out into the market. And so the problem becomes is that's very short-term thinking. So what's good now and hot now may not be hot in 20 years,
right?
Right. So when you don't include the faculty in there who take a much more longer view, often have the institutional memory that's not dependent and not worried about fluctuations in enrollment, and can think about, you know, times before when such things have happened, and then offer solutions to the administration that don't involve just blowing up or shuttering an entire department or program, you get rid of them and that's gone. And the administration just runs rampant and does whatever they want.
Right, exactly.
So again, it's that neoliberalization, that neoliberal economic theory that these folks are bringing with them from those private sector corporations. And then you get this, let's all cut and hack to make sure the bottom line is, you know, that we're soluble. But to what end, right? So
right.
You're not offering half the programs you used to, or they're a jumbled mess, or you have students who are stuck because you didn't understand what it took on the backside to actually arrange a curricula so
exactly.
The prerequisites could go places, or you could get students to transfer. You didn't know how to make agreements with other schools. And now you have these students who have, like, you know, so many credit hours, and they have nothing, there's nothing they can do with them. They can't transfer any place. They can't finish at the institution. And so the problem becomes that our work environment is a student's learning environment, as well as their ability to finish and get that degree that they've been working on. And the administration, by and large, just does not, they either don't get it or they don't care, right? Because again, they're looking at how much money am I going to save by eliminating this professor, these professors, and these departments.
Yeah, you know, and to your point there about the financialization too as well, one of the things that this report does, I think, extraordinarily well in pointing all that out is that you get to see who these university presidents are, who these boards of trustees are, and very often they're coming out of these out of private industry. So it's even demonstrated in, you know, the CVs or the resumes of the people who are kind of making these decisions, these calls. And I also think, you know, that whole idea about seeing the, you know, just – I don't know, like the balance sheet approach to how we understand curriculum, as opposed to, I mean, you know, I can't tell you how often we talk when we're talking in curricular meetings just about, okay, how do you tier the curriculum, right? And so that you make sure that as a student is moving through, right, a program, yeah, that, you know, this course is actually going to provide these things. And so this course is built on top of it, right? So right. That it's making certain assumptions about what comes before it, right?
Right.
Or, you know, we have, I don't know, this is, I mean, I know this is true across the country, is that you have particular programs which draw from courses in other fields, right? That are actually embedded in there, or assume certain things about the courses that were taken at the gen ed level, right? Mm-hmm. So it's like, so if I'm making the assumption that everyone at my university is required to take, just for an example, Introduction to Psychology, right? I can assume as a faculty member who's teaching, you know, in a different department, that my student has a basic understanding, or, you know, students coming into my class, kind of like say year three or two or three, has had that class. And so I can make certain assumptions, right? And I know that if that class is taught by somebody who's, you know, who's trained in the area, who's trained in that field, that I know that that's been conveyed. If, however, that class is replaced with, like, I don't know, like, you know, an online self-paced course that's offered by a kind of a contractor, like an outside contractor that, you know, students contribute, you know, and do during the summer, I have no idea, right? And so those things have direct impacts on everything else. Or if I remove that course entirely because I decided to eliminate the psychology program and fire all the psychology professors, suddenly there's a hole in my program, which seemingly had nothing to do with that, right? When these people come in and they are looking at balance sheets as the way of kind of approaching the budget, this is what they do. Right. They just look and they hack and they slash. And, you know, sometimes if they're really good at what they do, they give lip service to faculty. Right. They'll say, OK, come on these committees. And faculty eagerly try to kind of do their good. And then they're like, thank you for all the time that you put in this. But this was a dog and pony show. We're just going to slice you all up.
And that's one of the things that this report brings up, is that there are instances at a few of the different schools where they form these ad hoc committees, right? Because we were in the middle of the pandemic, things had to be done quickly. So ad hoc committees were formed, and the faculty responded, and they, you know, were involved. And then, just like you said, when they would present the findings of their report and their suggestions about what should be done, the administrator would say, thank you very much. And then they would announce something completely different to the rest of the university. And, you know, that then also becomes this moment of just mistrust, right? And these folks who are staying have to stay. Like, they're going to stay. They've already built their lives there. We're often, you know, tethered as professors to where we're at because we get tenure, right? And, you know, we've built our lives there. And you suddenly have this horrible morale you know, just morale vacuum that sucks all the motivation out of anything. And that's one of the things that the report also brings up, is that, you know, there are also, much like we were talking about earlier, there's emotional labor involved, and it just makes people tired, right? And they just are, they just don't have the will to continue. And then, like you're saying, something the report refers to as well is what they call character of the university. The administrators don't understand that. I think what they were trying to get at is what you're saying, is that, like, particular schools are known for specific things. So our shared alma mater, our alma mater of Syracuse University, one of the big things it's known for is,
public communication, Maxwell School of Citizenship. Yes, indeed.
Yes, Maxwell City, right.
Political science, SU. Yeah. Just saying.
No. The Maxwell School, right? Or Newhouse, right?
Newhouse, yep.
Right, so if SU cut Newhouse or Maxwell out just because on a balance sheet it made sense, you know, then it would be really strange, because other universities and other professors who have known SU for those two schools, right, those two colleges in the large university, they would be thrown by that, right? And it changes, like, also in recruitment, which supposedly all these administrators constantly are saying they're worried about in this report, is that you suddenly have students who will stop going to that school because Newhouse doesn't exist, Maxwell doesn't exist, right? There's no reason for them to go to that school anymore. And so again, it's short-term thinking, right? Yep. It's like, this makes sense for financial quarter, you know, 2021, spring 2021. But it's like, okay, but you just got rid of Maxwell. Now, what's gonna happen 5, 6, 10, 20 years down the road?
Absolutely.
You know, and it's just something that administrators, again, just don't think about because they're just too short-sighted.
No,
it's
and
just,
you know,
the corporate model.
No, and in some ways, this is like, you know, this is like a basic lesson which everybody should know, right? It's easier to tear something down than it is to build something up, right? It takes substantially less time to rip something down, right? To cut, to destroy, than it does to actually build something up, right? Because you're talking, just like you said, for example, use SU as the example, since you were just talking about it. If you take a school, which is kind of like, you know, is known like Maxwell School of Citizenship or Newhouse School of Communication, and that has been built up over decades and decades, right, of work and reputation, right, and development. If you just eliminate that, you can't just bring it back the next year, right. Right? It's gone.
It's gone
for the foreseeable right. future. And it, right. it's like that. And what I think is particularly in this report, is, you know, these are colleges, like you said, are mostly kind of smaller liberal arts colleges that are being focused on here. Although I should say, the authors say at the very beginning, since this report has come out, even in draft form, they're getting a flood of people who are saying this is happening here too, this is happening here too, and they're very careful to say, look, we know that this is not a comprehensive look in this report, but we're recognizing these things, we're going to focus on this, and a flood of examples have already started coming in again. So we're going to see, I'm sure we're going to see a revised version of this report right in the near future, where we're going to see how deep this problem is. But when you're talking about a liberal arts college, right, that is eliminating programs, right, you already are dealing with a fairly small faculty and a smaller student body. To eliminate that, I mean, it seems like the cost of trying to bring back a program or kind of invest in that is even higher for those schools.
Right, and that's one of the things that the report, I think, hints at but doesn't make clear, is like, there's no solid plan, you know, what's going to happen now. Because you're right, you're talking about, I think one of the schools had like 2,300 undergraduates,
yes, yep.
52 graduate students,
correct.
You know, a faculty of like 50 or 60, and then like 195 adjuncts. And, you know, what is the plan then? Like, if that's what it's known for, like in the Pashi system, which unfortunately is also mentioned in the report, at the very end of the notes,
yep.
Like in the Pashi system, like certain schools within the system are known for certain things. If you take that away, well, what's the draw, right? What are you going to use to draw? And the administrators constantly say, well, we're having to compete in a small region, you know, against larger state universities that have more sorts of like oomph to them, like more of a brand, right? And it's like, okay, but you're already known for one thing. If you're not going to provide that, what are you going to do, right? And that's something the report sort of gets at but doesn't actually talk about directly. And this is my other big point too, and I know I keep stressing this, but just like, you know, we've seen with the larger public discussion about critical race theory and critical race
yes.
studies. Most people see it as critical race theory, but it's also critical race studies is what they're also using with that boogeyman turn CRT.
And really what we're talking about, can we just say this? This drives me crazy. I have these conversations with people all the time. Say, you know what we say critical race theory? You know what we mean? You know what's actually talking about here? We're actually talking about like actually what happened in history and how to understand it, right? I mean, seriously. I mean, it's like, I mean, what drives me insane is that most of what you see people objecting to, especially in the right wing fringe areas like I'm in, is like you people, really what you're saying is I want my kids to be taught lies. I don't want them to know everything. I want them to know a story. I don't want them to know the truth. So I'm sorry, that's a total aside, but I mean, I know critical race theory has is much deeper than that, but really, I mean, that's the level of the conversation we're at sometimes in this country. And that's, so they're off the rails. Kevin just went. Anyways.
It's fine. No, I mean, it's something that, you know, when you see it and it seems so obvious and other people are up in arms, it's frustrating. I get it, right? I'm there with you, right? That's why we're all so tired.
Yeah, exactly. And, good point.
You know, but that's the thing is the sort of legislature, the legislators who are creating these acts, they're trying to pass these bills as laws to limit CRT or CRS, you know, in these different places. You know, they often are working on the premise of it's these crazy radical liberals in these universities that run these universities and these colleges that are pushing this anti-white, you know, anti-white sentiment or this, you know, reverse racism or whatever they're calling it these days. And the biggest thing is like, no, that's not who runs the university, right? And that's not who has the power of the purse strings. Exactly. And that's something that I think the report also makes glaringly clear is that it's not me, it's not Kevin, you know, running the university, because it'd be a heck of a lot different if we were.
That's for sure.
You know, it's these people who have had titles of CEO, CFO, right? People who have worked at IBM, right? So like, you know, the SUNY Board of Trustees, which is the state university of New York system. Mm-hmm. Almost all the entire board of trustees, they too are all CEOs and CFOs. And the fellow who came out of who mentioned and was talking and defending not having a public search, a transparent search for a new chancellor of that system, was saying, well, when I was at IBM, in-house promotions were just common, right? And that's just the way it goes. And so it's that move. That's what that report really gets to. I think this report's really getting to is like, this is who's really in charge of the universities. And these folks are not looking at the long-term health of a university or college that they're in charge of. They're looking at financial quarters. And I think that's something that needs to be brought back to that CRT, CRS discussion at some point. Like, you know, the premise is wrong. You know, the radicals aren't running the university. It's the conservatives. So, I mean, I don't know. I mean, the conservatives just seem to clean house or something, I guess. I don't know.
Well, no, I mean, they've got a new slogan for the 21st century. It's like, destroy it and they will come. You know, and it's like, it's a reverse of the way it used to be, right? It's just like, we'll turn everything on its head. Why not? Yeah. But okay, so just to kind of close out a little bit on this report. So where the way that this is structured, we go through a series of case studies of different universities and colleges kind of across the country where the shared governance is really being gutted at a variety of levels. Now, were there any of them that really stood out where you kind of were just like, oh my God, like that? I mean, there's so many of them, but you have ones that kind of are examples that come out of this report that you found it particularly alarming.
Cayuga College, New York State. So going back to New York State, which amazingly, New York State was overrepresented in this report.
Really was, yes.
But at Cayuga College, you have a president who is joking there about, we're going to get rid of the big rock of tenure. And we want to get rid of the grievance process so we can deal with the hiring and firing the way we want to. Saying things out loud in public, like the thing with tenure, the old saying is that good professors don't need it and bad professors don't deserve it. And it's so infuriating because this person, again, like when he came into, and I believe his name, I forgot his name and I'd have to look it up. But he, when he came, Maker, I think, or Macker is his name.
He's at Medell College, that one.
Medell College. Yeah. I'm sorry. Medell College. Cayuga is mentioned in here, but Medell College is also in New York State. And you know, he talked about these things and he made it seem like getting out from tenure and getting out from having, you know, professors who are making real money for being there for 20 years and going through the hoops to get tenure and to get job security was somehow going to save them. But, you know, he said these things publicly and then refused to sort of acknowledge that, you know, when he received the stewardship of the college, he was level. The budget was balanced. And since he took over, it's running a $6.5 million deficit, right? So when he made all these moves, you know, again, this wasn't to fix really anything. It was more of, I think, a PR program to say like, oh, look what I'm doing to bring us out of this deficit that I caused, right? And so he wanted to rework it in that way. And then on top of that, he still got like a significant amount from the CARES Act once again. And, you know, he is still going through this termination. They still created a new handbook because, again, this wasn't a collective bargaining agreement, but a handbook. And in the handbook, it basically says that you have to sign it. It's a pledge to work there, and you have to sign it, and that you forego any sorts of rights and privileges you had with the old handbook, which is what everybody had agreed to and was actually pretty fair. And moreover, that the university has the right to terminate you, change the handbook at any time, as well as they have this huge statement that covers them from any sorts of different legal actions that could be taken. And it was like, if you don't, and they basically, he and the board of trustees said, if you don't sign this, we will consider you at will employees. Well, the alternative was 3-year contracts that, you know, again, and everything he did, like all the report, the people that the AUP interviewed, everything was arbitrary, who he fired, what programs he got rid of. There was no real sort of rhyme or reason to it. What ended up happening is that, you know, the faculty didn't sign. A majority of the faculty have not signed it. And they're at will employees because, you know, all they're being offered are 3-year contracts that are dependent on the president and the board of trustees deciding if they get to stay or not.
It's unbelievable. I mean, the language that was put in there. Let me just read what Brian was saying. Just listen to this language. This is what it says. The agreement also included a provision whereby the faculty member must acknowledge and agree, quote, that this is exactly what Brian said. I want to read it word for word so you get a sense of how this is actually what they were being asked to sign. The prior handbook was validly replaced and rescinded. So you basically had to say that even if you disagreed with that, you had to sign this saying that no, no, 1984, Big Brother. No, no, you're right. Right. So listen to that. And that the employee shall not claim any right, benefit, obligation or entitlement to any provision contained in the prior handbook. Right. It said the agreement also released the university, quote, irrevocably, all caps, right, irrevocably and unconditionally from any and all claims, demands, suits, causes of actions, obligations, promises, damages, fees, covenants, agreements, attorney's fees, costs, expenses, debts, contracts, and torts of every kind whatsoever. I swear to God, it says that, right? Yeah, every kind whatsoever, right, that the faculty member has ever had, now has, or ever may have.
Right.
I mean, it's like this is out of, I mean, as someone who loves sci-fi, this is out of sci-fi. I'm reading like Cory Doctorow's book, like Little Brother, where it's all about the surveillance capitalism and things like this. And I'm like, dude, this is what this looks like. Yeah. It's like they're basically saying that you have to sign your name saying that everything in that old contract was bad. And you agree that everything in this one is the way that it should be. In order as a condition of employment. Mm-hmm. That is unfreaking believable to me.
Yeah. And you're talking about people who have been and served at that college for, you know, decades, have PhDs, are recognized as, you know, scholars in their field, and now they're being treated like automatons, like robots,
right?
Like you will just come and work and you will do exactly what we say. You know, and this is just something that is just so outlandish and it's just so over the top.
It really is. And it's like, you know, this is the kind of stuff that we're seeing. So we're talking about this idea about, you know, about the attack on shared governance. And that is just, you know, at the top, I read that little piece from Colorado, like University of Colorado Boulder. Right. Where we kind of, you know, see like, hey, yeah, here, let's kind of like, you know, don't let's not a good like a good crisis go to waste, basically. Right. Which is, you know, by the way, that's the line that comes directly out of let's not a good pandemic go to waste. Good crisis go to waste. That comes directly from Milton Friedman. Right. Which is one of the kind of forefathers of disaster capitalism, as Naomi Klein lays out. Right. So we kind of see this going on now. if you've been paying, if you've been listening to the show at all for the past, any time over the past, I don't know, 4, 5, 6 years, we've been talking about exactly this stuff happening, about disaster capitalism being really the kind of modus operandi, right? Being the way things are being done right now, kind of across the board. And we see this happening in kind of in higher ed, it's like inexplicably. This report is, I guarantee you, right? It's been starting to get some great coverage, right? We saw a piece that came out in Inside Higher Ed. I think this is starting to make the rounds. I do kind of, you know, for people who don't mind getting in the weeds a little bit, what's great about this report is that you actually get to hear the timeline that happened at each university. One of the things that struck me, I'm forgetting which one of the universities was, it might have been Marion in Wisconsin, or maybe it was Keuka, it's one of the two, that this happened over the course of about 6 weeks. Right? No, less than that, about 4 weeks. It started at the very end of June of last year, right? And by the mid-July, right, faculty were already getting kind of like being told that their contracts are up, right? That they're being fired, right? That their programs are being eliminated. I mean, this is how quickly this turned. And so this kind of stuff is astounding. And let's not mince words here. What's at stake here? I mean, this is all about control and power. Right. I remember being asked as a little bit of a tangent. A few years back, I interviewed Colleen Bradley. She was the former kind of associate vice president of administration and finance at Westchester University, who blew the whistle about the financial malpractice in the Pashi system. Right. At Westchester, at Kutztown, a bunch of other places. And I remember having these conversations when I interviewed her for this kind of mini documentary I did with her, and her lawyer was part of that documentary too as well. When I was trying to explain to him, like off camera, he was saying, "Look, why are they doing this?" Right? Because he was convinced, right, is that it was the faculty, right? He was convinced that the faculty, the reason what was going on here is the faculty didn't want their money taken away. And I kept on saying to him, "Is like, you don't understand. These people are using the same lies to bludgeon us that they are to rip off the taxpayer," right? Mm-hmm. It's like, this is, and then he was astonished. And like, I can't tell you how many times he asked me, he's like, "Well, why are they doing it then?" And the only thing that I could come up with that was rational or reasonable is about control and power, right? And that's precisely what this is about. I mean, it is about, you know, how we're gonna determine what is gonna be the future of higher education, who gets to call the shots, right? And on what terms, right? And this is just shocking in my mind.
Yeah, it was Marion University, I think, in Wisconsin, Marion, that you're talking about. So they didn't even announce that the handbook had been voided, and they just started handing out terminations, saying it wasn't performance-based, right, that it was financial.
No, you were great. You were awesome.
But we just need the money. But then when pushed on it, they couldn't provide the financials that would explain how the termination of one professor or two professors would actually help the university. It's this really sort of strongman approach to running the university, running, you know, a university, a college, academia in general.
It's a great way of putting it.
Yeah, and it doesn't make a lot of sense. It's completely arbitrary. So if you go back to that fellow we were talking about at Medallion or Medallia, whatever it was.
Yeah.
You know, he was firing people, it almost seemed like, because he had a vendetta, right? You know, and so even in places like Marion, you had terminations where programs weren't being shuttered, but it was just like, well, you know, we just want to get rid of this person, even though, you know, and really what you end up seeing a lot of these positions when they weren't shuttering programs, but taking out professors, they were often taking out professors that had been there for years, that had tenure, were probably high up in the pay scale, you know, relatively speaking to that particular institution. Every institution's different. And at the same time, I think had that sort of institutional memory. Again, you know, and that sort of standing and that strength of being there for a long time to actually fight back and say like, "Hey, no, we're not going to do this. You can't do this," right? And knew the channels and knew how to operate and who to talk to. And once you get rid of that, once you take out those people who can organize, I mean, then, you know, basically the strong man can walk right in.
Right. Absolutely. And I think that
whatever you want to call it.
Yeah. I do think that is a great framework, though, about thinking about it in this particular era about that kind of control. And I do think that, you know, the other aspect of things that I wish I could get my colleagues to see this in, you know, as clearly as I think I do, at least if I want to, you know, pat myself on the back and think that I actually can see these things. But I mean, that this era of trust is gone, right? I mean, I think a lot of what we did and a lot of, you know, we started this with kind of thinking about, say, the Trump administration and so on. And I think a lot of the things that rested upon, you know, the way we've done or tradition, right? Or the idea that, you know, we cared about, we didn't want to be ashamed. We took some pride in what we did and we didn't want to get called out for being a liar or a hypocrite, that we wanted to do the, do our best, right? And and if we were exposed for that, it would be big shameful. That's kind of like out the window, right? And I still think that there's a lot of faculty, especially, you know, especially those folks who do not have unions, although even those with unions, right, still believe that, you know, look, there's the opportunity to do good faith discussions and kind of come to some reasonable solutions with their administration. And I'm not saying throw that out the window entirely, right? Because I think you have to do those things. But I think it's also time we got to say, look at what these people are doing. They just didn't care, right? They didn't care how it looked. They didn't care. They didn't, you know, they were exposed and they basically took full ownership of it. They didn't say like, oh my, I'm ashamed of what I've done. And they weren't shamed in reversing course. No, they doubled down, right? And I really do think that that's what we're, that we have to get our heads around that dynamic going forward.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, listen, we're coming up. We're coming up on time. I want to have. I was just looking at the time. I got a, little away. I got a little away from looking at the clock because I got charged up here. If there's anybody that is kind of want to call in, has a little question or comment, you can click on right in the show notes on YouTube. Make sure you shut down YouTube after you click that link, though, or at least silence it, so you don't get any feedback. But if you do want to call in, you want to join the conversation on Riverside, please feel free to click that link, and we go from there. But so. So, God, Brian, man, every time I talk to you, I feel like I could talk to you for 3 hours. I mean, it's in part because, you know, it just sometimes it feels good to be talking to somebody that kind of understands things along similar ways. Right. So you don't feel, at least I don't feel so kind of isolated or kind of like, you know, out there on the edge of things for all the time. But I mean, we had a lot of things. So some other things that you wanted to kind of say, bring into the discussion this evening before we have to kind of call it an evening.
Yeah. You know, I hate to be gloom and doom. Right.
Please. So that's my sweet spot.
Well, OK, we have to have some hope off in the distance to work towards. So
we'll get there.
Yeah, we'll get there. But, I think that, you know, a lot of us, you know, in that are working in the professoriate need to stop thinking ourselves as entitled. We need to stop thinking of ourselves as somehow protected. We need to realize that we are labor. We need to organize. If there is a handbook, you know, and that's great, you know, for your college or your university, but you definitely need to connect and start organizing so you have a contract in place that has legal teeth to it, financial money kind of teeth to it. So for instance, like with Bowling Green, right? Bowling Green is a good example.
It's a really good example.
They're one of the good stories out of Ohio. So they did have a problem, right? They had a problem with money. But through whether it was peaceful or not, I tend to think it isn't, but the faculty and the administration were able to work together when they had to call for re-entrenchment and they had to call financial exigency. And what they did at Bowling Green is they were able to, through negotiations between the faculty and the administration, come up with a severance package that worked within their collective bargaining agreement that made sure, as my colleague John McNay called it, a soft landing occurred for faculty who were being fired, right? So basically they were getting rid of people without tenure who had the least amount of time and seniority at the university. But they had so many months of severance pay that they could continue teaching up to a certain point. So they'd also have, they would be able to work and then they would receive severance pay once they stopped, as well as connect them to various services. So that way, you know, again, they could start to look for work. And that's, you know, there's some other things that happen there as well, but that's the ideal, right? Is that faculty administration can come together and work and say like, okay, we're not just going to leave people destitute, especially people who have already worked here for 5 or 6 years and haven't achieved tenure yet, right? If that's the case, like it was at Bowling Green, if you have tenure, you're staying, you know, last in, first out sort of concept. And that's what you would hope for, is a more humane process. And that's a possibility. You know, if you don't have a union, please organize one, please create one. If you're an adjunct, and especially if you're someplace in Ohio where it's very hard for adjuncts to organize. And so say like in Ohio, like the AAP cannot organize adjuncts, right? Because we've been classified in a specific way. We can only deal with certain academics. start looking at Adjuncts United, start reaching out to other groups, start trying to organize, start looking around. It's not just you. It's not your fault. You're not just tired and you didn't work hard enough. It's not just your individual institution. It's not just one, you know, administrator and you can go someplace else. This is happening all over. So the best thing you can do is get militant, or at least as militant as possible within a business or union, that, you know, you can organize and create and have that staff that's constantly working in administration, that's constantly policing that collective bargaining agreement, and that again sets teeth into an agreement, so that way you can't just get rid of the faculty handbook and you know the administration runs rampant and wild. The other thing, really quick, that I thought was really interesting is none of these colleges, these presidents and these colleges and these universities covered in this report, ever declared financial exigency, which was a big part of the faculty handbook. Like if they would have done that, then there was ways in the faculty handbook, like I described at Bowling Green, where they would have had a similar situation where they would have worked something out. And I think that's really interesting, is that even when it's available and that channel's there, the administration will not do it on their own, right? There's enough case studies and enough information that the administration is not going to do it on their own. So again, if you're listening, don't think that the administration is your friend. They're not. Please, they're your boss.
Please.
Right? Human resources doesn't work for you.
Right.
They work for your boss, right? And so, you know, that's the thing, is that you've got to make sure that you understand that, that you organize appropriately. And the other thing is, too, is I think it's also a pride thing. It's weird, too, with these presidents, these colleges. Like, they didn't want to, and they never did publicly announce financial exigency. So I think it's this really strange thing where, because they're from the corporate world, they don't want to be in charge of a sinking ship. And again, just like CFOs and CEOs at other places, since we've been hiring those folks in higher ed now, they split with golden parachutes and they move on and go someplace else. They just need to look good while they're there until they get the next gig.
Absolutely. I see we were joined by Nick. Nick, if you do have a call or a comment that you want to kind of jump in, just go ahead and call in. We could take your call. I saw he just joined in Riverside. Nick, are you there? Oh, maybe not. He popped in from one. If he does pop up before we take off, I'll try to take him quick. That's, I think, a fantastic place to kind of think about moving forward. And I know that one of the things that we've been talking about on the show quite a bit is that, you know, also the need to organize across sectors and with other people at the university. I mean, I think that one of the things that we learned, I think, from watching what happened in Kentucky, watching what happened in, you know, a lot of these kind of red states, kind of right to work states, where teachers, you know, despite the fact that it was not allowable, it was not like legal, they weren't given the right to do this. They struck, right? And they organized, right? Because they knew that, like, if they were not going to do that, if they were not going to stand up, they were going to lose the very thing that they loved. Right. Mm-hmm. That they were the only people that were protecting. They were the only ones that could protect what was happening in the classroom and what was happening with the students in the communities. And so they organized with communities. They organized with the staff at their schools, and they organized in any place that they could. And we need to kind of really think about that as the organizing model.
Yeah. And again, as I've said before, and a lot of folks who are in a union and work in education will say, our working conditions are our students' learning conditions. And so whatever we're suffering, they're going to suffer right along with us. And so we always think, at least at the AAUP, that we should have a focus on the educational mission, because that's what we're supposed to be doing, is educating students. And to do that, you need faculty and staff who are, you know, paid a living wage, who are able to take care of themselves, who have what they need to actually do their jobs. And that's one of the things, too, as well as, like you said, organizing across unions, talking to other folks, getting involved, you know, making it a front is going to be really a key and important in this. You know, and again, it's just, even on all levels, that going across, you know, different unions and such, like, I don't think people also recognize that a lot of these places, and I know this is probably true in Poshie, I know it's true where I went to school and I was part of the Cal State system, like, these are the places that are they're the big employers in that area, in that region. So if you start losing students because of short-sighted management decisions, that means that, like, it's not just a professor and a student that are gone. It means that there are administrative assistants who are gone, accountants are gone, grounds crew are gone, you know, electricians who were hired, you know, university police, you know, all the campus police, all those different sort of departments that make universities and colleges run, and those jobs they need are gone. And that means that your region has lost a major employment nexus.
Crazy, crazy, crazy. Well, man, I can only hope that we there's going to be some positive stuff moving forward. I mean, I think that I've been very encouraged. I don't know if it's this is true kind of out your way, too, as well. I have been encouraged to see. Let me just do this real quick. Let me check what's going on here. I've been very encouraged to see kind of organizing going on. Like I mentioned to you actually before the show, like I know that Nick, who's trying to kind of hop on, keeps on trying to hop on here, was kind of running into some kind of glorious technological problems, as we all learned how to cope with these here. But he's been organizing kind of students about, you know, around free college tuition, about kind of saving kind of the state system of higher education. We've seen student organizers, we've seen Black Lives Matter organizers beginning to work together and, you know, really link up struggles across the way, whether it's kind of like struggles for public education, public higher education, for housing, right, with racial justice, right, and with labor, right, and with historical injustices. And beginning to, what I'm very pleased about, this is something else I really like about this report, is that, you know, it names names. Right. It basically says, here's this university and here's this president or here's this provost or here's these board of trustees. And these are what they did and the decisions that they made. And I really do think we have to start seeing that these people are not making the interest in the best interest of higher education or the best interest of the future. So,
yeah, absolutely. Yeah. And if we lose, you know, the other thing we lose with shared governance is academic freedom. So, you know, the idea to be able to push in and do research on areas that are uncomfortable, right, for people, whether it's talking about race in America, as we mentioned with CRT and CRS, you know, once you don't have those protections of shared governance and the idea to push back and say, like, this is called academic freedom, this professor has the right to teach these things and research this stuff, you're going to see like a definite cooling of scholarship, especially coming out of the arts and sciences. And you will basically have, you know, what I envision, unfortunately, is like more like a corporate training ground, because it'll be just very fact based and, you know, everything will be geared towards business, you know, or, yeah, you know, I don't know. It's just it's worst case scenario.
Hey, I think we got Nick come in. So, Nick, you got in right before I was going to close off. I tried to keep it I'm open sorry. As much. But no. It's not you. It's not you. Believe me.
I ended up digging up the link that you had sent Alex and I way back when, because I figured that link would work. I don't know, but it is what it is.
Well, welcome, Nick. Meet Brian. Brian, meet Nick. What's up, Nick? What's on your mind?
Well, I will update. I would say PASHI defenders, along with other allies, have had in a way of a victory. You know, PASHI defenders, along with the Party for Socialism of Liberation in Chester County, held a rally in Westchester. And, you know, there weren't too many of us, actually. There was, you know, like 5, 6, 7. We were sort of really trying to target and pressure Chester County Commissioner and Board of Governor member Marian Moskowitz to vote no on the consolidation plans, right? Out of the blue, she came. She came to the rally. We talked to her. She sort of said, I don't know how I'm going to vote. I want to come listen to you. Now, while I think that that's a good sign, I also think that in a way she's, you know, doing that to just sort of save face, right? But out of that and out of me stating specifically, which is very true, the chancellor lied directly on the integration workshop, or one of his, you know, people. I think it was the deputy chancellor, because they mentioned that these public comments that are coming in, either through the form or via email, which I sent one back, I think it was May 12th, were getting email responses saying that they have been received or read. That's what they said. The day of that workshop, I had looked, had not gotten anything of the sort. It wasn't until the following day I got an email about the integration workshop, this, that, and the other thing. So what did I tell Marian Moskowitz? The chancellor lied, because he did at that time. So I ended up getting a phone call with Chester County Commissioner Moskowitz on Saturday. It was a very good phone call in certain ways. But I ended up pressuring her, you know, along with others working together. She ended up having a phone conversation with the chancellor late the night before. She was told of the quote-unquote broad right-to-know request that I sent to the chancellor's office, which I know we're not going to get anything probably until right before the vote, but we're going to try, right? And we're asking for the public comments. We're asking for certain communications that the chancellor has had. But, you know, we will see what we will get. As well, we're currently trying to pressure the Chester County Commissioner, Board of Governor member, Marian Moskowitz, to have an open forum with faculty, staff, students at Westchester, specifically about this consolidation. You know, and anyone would be welcome. I mean, but, you know, we're seeing if that's a possibility. She said that she needed to check back with the president of Westchester University to see, because she wanted to make sure he would be invited there, I'm sure, as backup. But, you know, we'll see how that goes. So please, 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 I really want folks to continue to help us target Chester County Commissioner Moskowitz as well through PASHI Defenders. If you email us, I will gladly give you some of the resources that we have. We have some of the numbers of these folks who are on the Board of Governors. We need people to call them. We need people to email them. We need people to do anything they can to keep up the pressure. And also know there are some different rallies that are coming up at some of these universities that are slated for consolidation that we're doing along with PSL, as well as there's, like, you know, there are the open forums, which people, if you were going to go to these open forums, please email us. I have a nice Zoom background and a Zoom profile picture that says vote no on consolidation, just to show them. So if they want us to turn off our cameras, it's still going to be there. So please, we have resources and we are trying to give them out to folks and have folks come with us to this fight. So that's sort of my update in a way. I think I said mostly everything.
Well, Brian, we were talking about ending the night on a positive note.
Thank you. You're welcome. Thank you. Thank you. You gave us our out, man.
Good. You know, I tried. And sorry that it took me so long. I was on a phone call previously, somewhat listening in, but, you know, its own thing. But otherwise, good stuff, Brian, from you as well. And thank you, Kevin, for, you know, letting me hop on at the tail end.
No, you got it. But I think that, you know, and I will say, so Nick, before you go, how can people get in touch with PASHI Defenders?
Yeah, so you can email us at PASHIDefenders@gmail.com. We as well have a Twitter, which is @DefendersPASHI. We have a Facebook. We have an Instagram as well. The Facebook is PASHI Defenders, and then the Instagram is PASHI_Defenders. You know, please email us or contact us through there. We have a Google form, or we have a petition, and, you know, you'll sort of get in contact from us through either of those ways.
And so if there's anybody listening, and even if your folks are kind of out in Ohio, kind of like joining on to kind of see what Brian is saying, like, hit them up, because I know that one of the things that you've heard, Nick was on the show a couple weeks back, and one of the things that Nick is very interested in is what students have been doing at other campuses and other universities, kind of like different states, right, beginning to work with each other, right, sharing knowledge, sharing tactics, sharing what works. And one of the things that you just heard Nick say is like not only do you have kind of organization over a concept and idea, but you got pressure at key points, like at, you know, with key legislators, state legislators, there can actually have an impact, right, at the same time that you're organizing, organizing for power. So, you know, kudos, Nick, and please do get in touch with them, and feel free. And I'll vouch for Nick. He's friendly. He's not going to bite you. He'll be happy to get an email from you, you know, even if you're not part of PASHI. Building power among students right now, I think, is so absolutely critically important, as it is of building the same power among faculty and with faculty and students together. So thanks for hopping on, Nick. I appreciate it, man.
Of course. Thanks for having me.
All right. And Brian, hey, you got any closing words for the evening?
No, I like what Nick said. Let's just say it.
I'm with you. All right, good. Well, Brian, hey listen, I do appreciate so much for you taking the time. And I know you've got kind of a lot going on. It's Memorial Day. You just got newly tenured. You just got had a birthday. And he's got all sorts of things going on. So I appreciate you so much for coming on and, you know, kind of sharing this space with me once again, man. It always makes me feel like, you know, one step closer to the struggle. So I appreciate it, man.
No problem. I'm always happy to come on. Thank you for having me. One more time, just let me learn. I just want to let you know, I appreciate you letting me on.
Oh, man, you got it. You kidding me? Absolutely. So listen, this, everybody, this is Kevin Mahoney, editor and founder of Raging Chicken. Sorry for the little, say, techno glitches there toward the end. That's on my end. Nick wants to take credit for the glitches. He does not get to. It's all on me. All right. So, everybody, I want you to have a good one. Enjoy the rest of your time. We'll talk to you soon.
My face, see ya.
My arms, can't tell if I exist. Am I the sky, the rock, or tree falling in the forest? I had a friend once, at least I think I did. I almost can't remember exactly what a friend is. There are no people in the future. No people. There are no people.